This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Episode number 56. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And today's kind of a special episode. We're very fortunate to have an interview that we've been hoping to do for a long time now with Joe Abercrombie.
Yes, we got a chance to talk with him on Sunday. And let me tell you, the guy is super nice. We messed up the time because we had the time change here.
Daylight saving.
And we call him in the middle of, he's like playing hide and seek with his daughter. It was so cute. But he was so gracious and so nice. And we came up with a compromise time when we could call him back and do the interview. And he took, we thought we would only talk to him for like maybe 15 minutes. We spent a half an hour talking to him. We could have talked to him for hours, but we had to let him go and get back to his family.
Yes, extremely smart guy. Had a lot of interesting things to say. And hopefully, if you guys haven't read any of his books yet, you will be, you know, encouraged to. Because
yeah.
I think they're all excellent. I'm still in the middle of reading, actually close to the end of reading Best Served Cold right now. So I'm looking forward to getting started with The Hero soon.
And I'm right at the beginning of Best Served Cold, and I can tell you there are no spoilers in this interview. If you haven't read any Joe Abercrombie, you will not have a problem listening to this interview. Now, getting back to the business, we'll have a regular episode of Sword and Laser with Quick Burns and Bury Your Sword and all that stuff the next time we meet, at which point we will wrap up our book pick.
Yes, our book pick, Shadow of the Torturer. And by Gene Wolfe. And I have to say, I really should have gotten around to listening to Claw by this point. I feel like I finished with Shadow of the Torturer, and I should have moved on to The Claw, and I just didn't. And I think everyone else in the book club has pretty much read it all together at the same time because they're not separated out like they are on the Audible selections.
Yeah.
But I'll get around to it eventually. I'd like to know how that story works out.
Oh, yeah. Frankly, once you get into Claw of the Conciliator, you're going to want to go ahead and read the last two books in the series as well, because it's all one big, long, sprawling story that you want to find out where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Speaking of audiobooks, this podcast, this interview with Joe, is brought to you by Audible.com. As always, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, 75,000 downloadable titles, all types of literature, not just fiction, nonfiction as well, periodicals. And they are nice enough to not only sponsor Sword and Laser, but give you a free audiobook of your choice by going to audiblepodcast.com/sword. Now, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/other things and get free audiobooks. But if you like us and you want Audible to keep continuing to support us and allowing us to continue to do episodes more frequently. I don't know if you've noticed, but we have more episodes these days, and it's not entirely a coincidence. So go to audiblepodcast.com/sword, and they have, if you're interested in Joe Abercrombie after this interview or even already, all of his books available on Audible.
Yeah, so you can get one for free, and then I think they're even having a sale on his books as well.
Yeah,
so
there's a spring cleaning sale going on right now as we're talking about. Let's say you get The Blade Itself, The First Law, Book 1 for free at audiblepodcast.com/sword. You could then buy Book 2 for $7.81.
Not a bad deal. Not bad at all. All right, well, let's jump right into the interview with Joe Abercrombie. Joining us today is Joe Abercrombie. He's the author of the First Law trilogy, which includes The Blade Itself, Before They Are Hanged, and The Last Argument of Kings, as well as some standalone fantasy novels like Best Served Cold and newly The Heroes. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So we wanted to get right into to your writing style, because there's been a lot of controversy lately on all the blog sites, it seems, about postmodern
blog
fantasy.
Sites never short of controversy, are they, though?
No, they are not. So why do you feel that you want to take fantasy into kind of a darker place?
What's with all the blood?
What's with all the blood?
Does this have anything to do with your 2008 incident with the banister?
Possibly. I don't know. That sent me straight, I think, probably. Sent me out of the bloody arena. I don't know. I think I've never claimed to be doing anything particularly revolutionary. You know, I feel like I'm working within a form, really. That's what interests me, largely, to work within a recognisable form. So I'm not trying to do anything revolutionary. I suppose it had always been my observation, though, reading a lot of fantasy as a kid and a young man, that there's a lot of violence in fantasy books, Lord of the Rings and so on, very violent books, lots of war, lots of melees, lots of swords. But often the kind of, the negative consequences of violence that one would probably observe in, say, a fracas in the street involving a banister, or for that matter, a war, a lot of the negative consequences tend to get glossed over. You know, there's a focus on the shiny and the heroic. And I suppose I wanted to try and, when doing my take on epic fantasy, which is really what I think the first law is largely, I wanted to try and present something realistic is a difficult word when you're talking about a world that is basically invented, but something that felt authentic, that felt kind of
maybe believable,
tough.
Even
believable, yeah, exactly. That felt kind of emotionally real, and in which there were costs and consequences, and you know, violent people didn't just walk away intact to become wonderful kings, lovers, and friends. You know, they were people who ended up physically and psychologically damaged by their experiences. So, I guess I would argue in a way that there's no more violence in my work than there is in a lot of fantasy, but that violence is certainly a lot more intimate, possibly a lot more detailed. So I think it's more of a different approach to violence rather than that there is a lot more necessarily.
Sort of the difference between, say, I don't know, The Sopranos on HBO here in the U.S. I know you got it over there in the U.K. as well, versus
sure.
The A-Team, where they're all, you know, shooting each other with machine guns, but no one's allowed to be shown being killed, and they just fall down.
Yeah, or in fact, Cabbage firing pneumatic cannons in one memorable episode of the A-Team that I recall. I suppose that's a good metaphor, or perhaps one like, I might use one like, you know, an old school Western like, say, Gunfight at the OK Corral versus a sort of modern reinterpretation like an Unforgiven, where, you know, Gunfight at the OK Corral probably has a far higher body count than Unforgiven. Unforgiven has very few people actually killed in it for a Western, but they make those events really count. They feel absolutely real and quite devastating and unpleasant. Whereas in Gunfight at the OK Corral, you know, a great film, don't get me wrong, in just the same way as a lot of traditional fantasy is great, but it doesn't have the same focus on the consequences and the kind of, the detail of how it happens, I suppose.
Which I think makes it easier to subsume yourself in a world when the consequences start to seem real. It seems like you're reading something real then. I think that's why a lot of people like it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I suppose I was very interested in trying to get close to the characters as well. I mean, I suppose it had been my observation that a lot of epic fantasy, obviously it's set in other worlds. That's in a way what separates it from other fiction. And so often there's a concentration on what makes that world different from ours, on the geography and the magic and the kind of politics and a focus on the setting, in a sense. And I felt like that had become a motif that I was seeing a lot in fantasy. And so I wanted to try, if I could, to write something that focused much more on the characters, I suppose, and I guess to focus more on those things that fantasy has in common with everything else, character and plot and action, than to focus on those things that separate it, that is, you know, the magic and the fantastical elements. Still to have some of those there, but really to focus on the characters. And so again, the approach and the action is to make you feel like you're there, part of it. I mean, one metaphor that I often boringly use a lot is, a filmic one that fantasy of the kind of Tolkien, the Tolkien mold, feels like it's told in big wide shots. You see these huge scape, these huge mountainscapes and these huge landscapes and these huge worlds, but the characters are sometimes a little bit lost in there. You know, you don't feel intimately connected with them. I want to tell something in very tight close-up where the setting is you know, hopefully still a vivid backdrop, but very much a backdrop, and the characters are to the fore, and you feel perhaps almost uncomfortably pressed up against them and know exactly how they feel and what's going on.
That's what exactly they smell what like. I was going to use, the uncomfortable feeling, because you are so close and in their face and living every moment. It does sometimes feel very, very personal.
Yeah, well, I'd hope so. That's what I'm aiming at, and I'm sure, you know, the mileage always varies with these things. There's no right way of doing anything. There's just different approaches and different approaches that connect with some readers. But you know, as a writer, you've effectively got to, I think, just select that style of approaches, pick out the thing from the toolbox that you feel works for you, that works for your story, that is kind of means you're writing from a place of honesty, if you like. That's a little bit pretentious, but it's important to be truthful. And for every writer, that means a different approach. So I'd never be kind of prescriptive in saying, well, the way to write great stuff is to focus on characters and action and ignore the backdrop, for that is worthless. Other people very, very successfully and effectively do the opposite. But, you know, for me, I try to, connect people with the characters and hopefully to make those characters feel like they're conflicted, as I think people who are drawn into these violent situations or that you often see in fantasy, you know, might often be. You know, soldiers rarely come back from war without some damage of one kind or another.
Yeah, I feel you do a really good job of that, because I almost uncomfortably have a sense of how the Bloody Nine might smell.
Smell, I think, is a much overlooked sense in fantasy. We're often invited to stare upon the glittering towers, and rarely are we asked to smell them. So I think it's important.
Yeah. Now, we always want to find out the influences of authors, but it's always such a dull question. So I'm going to try to spice it up and assume that your inspiration comes wholly from within, and that any similarity to previous authors is the fault of them time traveling.
Well, I can't see any other alternative, because, as you say, I stand entirely alone,
right,
as a colossus with the waves of lesser works breaking upon his ankles.
That being said, what unethical scum have stolen from your work and then taken their ill-gotten time machines to publish previously to you and make themselves look like influences?
Well, there's a guy you probably, I'm sure you won't have heard of. He's not well known. Is it called Tolkien? Another English guy.
No.
He really did. I think I had a profound effect on his upbringing, evidently, because, you know, I see a lot of him in my work. He obviously, no one who works in fantasy can kind of ignore Tolkien, I wouldn't have thought. So I read a lot of that when I was a kid. I used to reread Lord of the Rings every year, and that made an indelible sort of impression on me. And I was a big role player when I was younger. You probably interview, I would think, 10 or 15 authors who would give exactly the same answers as I'm going to.
I don't think you've been role-playing before. I think that's a first, yeah.
Really? Oh, well, I mean, yeah, a lot of the odd-shaped dice and Dungeons & Dragons. And
okay, you mean Dungeons & Dragons. I was thinking LARPing.
Oh, no, not so much. No, not too much investment in costumes required for that, unfortunately.
Very expensive, yeah.
Yeah, no, more the dice and paper stuff, yeah.
So you did mention Tolkien, and so having him as such an influence, or rather having him steal your work, must have been when Leo Grin wrote that article on Big Hollywood, and we've discussed this a lot in our forums. He made all these big statements about how postmodern fantasy is killing the genre, and he specifically referred to Tolkien. How did that make you feel to kind of have him say that, to say those things, to say that the kind of fantasy you're writing, which obviously we think is just as relevant as anything else out there, it's wonderful. Mm. How did that make you feel personally to have him say those kinds of things?
Well, usually it's always difficult criticism, and it's most unpleasant, I think, when you know they've got a point. Yeah. So I think I just felt a bit bemused by that article, really, because it didn't seem to really, apart from all the hyperbolic kind of language and so on, it didn't really feel like it reflected the world as I understand it at all. Didn't really feel like it reflected how genre works, how literature works. it just seemed kind of bizarre. I mean, I'm sure there are people, it's a big world, so I'm sure there are people to whom that article spoke deeply and who recognise everything they read in there. But to me, it was just a bit baffling, really, because, you know, the genre, like any, develops, one author builds on the other, you know, and obviously there'd be no epic fantasy without Tolkien there. Likewise, Howard, who was the other one who was brought up, has been a huge influence, I think, in a way, especially on role-playing and computer gaming. He's the man alone in the dark world has kind of not been such an influence within literature, because Tolkien has sort of bagged that area in a way with a much more epic, big thing. But that thing of the man alone, the sword and sorcery, that tends to be very influential within computer games and role-playing, which, again, has been a big influence on me. So I see these guys as, you know, my big influences, some of my big influences, and influences on those who then have gone on to influence me at other times. So it's just baffling, really.
It's especially surprising because he doesn't even care for fantasy per se.
Yeah, I don't know. It's full of a kind of, that particular article is obviously full of a style of this very over the top hyperbolic language with lots of
mythopoeic subcreation.
Mythopoeic, yeah. And lots of poo-based metaphors. Did you notice that? that seems surprising. He was very upset about the scatology of fantasy, but then he complains about these jaded literary sewers, these overflowing commodes that these books represent. I don't know. It's the overblown language, really. I think there certainly is an argument there that you know, is something I hear quite a lot about people who feel that there's something lost in a lot of the more edgy, gritty kind of modern fantasy that we're probably seeing more of now. And that they, you know, perhaps hanker after a kind of simpler, well, simpler is maybe the wrong word, but a more heroic, more obviously sympathetic, you know, something they can get a grip on. They don't necessarily want to read very ambiguous stories. They want some good and evil, and there's nothing wrong with that at all.
It reminds me of rock and roll came along, and everyone said, "Oh, I miss the tunes. I miss the music of the past." And it's sort of the same reaction.
This is the music of the devil, and will destroy your mind should you listen to it. Mm-hmm. And but you know, that seems, I can totally understand why people might not like it. That's you know, par for the course. You've got to accept there'll always be people who don't like what you do, however foolish and misguided they may be. But to have such a visceral reaction of this is dangerous, this is a kind of a wrong turn, seems to me weird. I mean, if the turn that a genre takes or that a certain kind of art takes is worthless and has nothing to offer, you know, then ultimately it'll just wither away. And I'm sure there are, to be honest, lots of very traditional fantasies being published very, very successfully. Doing gritty, ambiguous stuff is not, I don't think, necessarily the high road to huge commercial success, necessarily. There's still plenty of successful traditional authors. So I don't see it as destroying anything. It's just a new interpretation, a slightly different way to do things.
Do you think people are upset over the general lack of happy endings? You know, people don't feel, maybe that's what they're looking for, and so they're taking this kind of frustration out on the fact that you know, they're taking it out on the rest of the genre just because they're looking for that kind of, like, you know, everything comes together in the end.
Well, you know, people want what they want, in a way. I mean, there's no shame in enjoying or not enjoying something. I think it's very easy to be kind of judgmental. And the thing is, since I've published, I used to be incredibly judgmental and harsh myself and brutal about things I didn't like. But having seen my stuff go out into the world and people be brutal about it, I'm much more kind of laissez-faire, I suppose, much more live and let live in the way that I think about these things now. And so, you know, some people want a neat resolution to things. Some people feel very frustrated by not getting one. I mean, I like an ending that is sort of ragged, that has things carrying on, some things resolved, some things not, some things you know, some things you don't, just as you do in real life generally. You know, few wars end with a victory and there you go, that's the end of the story. If you end the story of the Iraq war with President Bush declaring victory on his aircraft carrier, you miss the point in a way, because things always carry on and the seeds of the next conflict are buried in the end of the last and so on. So I like things that are quite ragged in that way. I find that realistic. I find that truthful. But other people don't. You know, they'd rather have resolution. And funny enough, I watched No Country for Old Men not long ago, very much feeling quite smug in my love for the real and the harsh. Yeah, yeah. And I did find the way that completely ignores narrative convention and completely refuses to give you any satisfaction in the way the story works, you know. I found that a bit hard to take. Mm-hmm. And so I think everyone has their level. Everyone has their things they like and they don't. And really, as a writer, you just have to try and, you know, be truthful, do something you like, and hope it will connect with some readers. But you've got to be aware it's never going to connect with all of them.
Yeah, I think the reading public is becoming more sophisticated in general about things. And so somebody like Tolkien comes along and gives you something that we've really never seen, a wholly created universe and a wholly created language and all of this. And then eventually, as much loved as it is, somebody wants to see somebody do something new. And so you get people trying to say, well, let's put some more believability in there. Okay, that was grand. But I want to see what happens actually in the sword fight. I want to see those close scenes. And your world that you're creating is very vast and yet consistent. And that's a quality we're seeing in a lot of writers like George R.R. Martin, like Patrick Rothfuss, like many others. Do you develop a world like Tolkien? Do you have notes and languages and things set out that aren't in every book that you use to inform it? Or do you just kind of have a sense for what the story should look like and what that world should look like?
I certainly have a good amount of source material, both kind of written down and that's in my head. I suppose I played a lot of, as we were saying, role-playing stuff as a kid and drew a lot of maps in the process of that. Came up with a few ideas, but stole most of them from other people. Stole my own combination of ideas.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was lurking around in my head. So I had some ideas for the history and for the big figures of the past and some of the, you know, nations of the present. And then as I started writing, I started to, you know, make this a bit more explicit and produce some timelines and things of that nature. But I try to keep a light hand on that generally. And I try to, because ultimately as a writer, you do have to produce work and you there is a limit to the amount of time you have, a limit to the amount of effort you put in, and stuff that effort you put into one thing is effort that you're not putting into another place in a way. And so for me, the focus is more on the characters and the detail of what is in the book, the detail of writing itself. And I try to keep the source material enough that it produces something that is consistent and feels, you know, like a convincing backdrop, as you say, but it's not my focus anyway. And you know, languages and so on, you know, Tolkien obviously was a huge enthusiast for language and his invented languages derive from that. You can't fake the kind of authenticity that he produces in the naming and the conventions of language and the whole depth of history that is very much inextricably linked into how the languages work. And that's why he is the best at that. He's untouchable really at that. But that's, in a way, I suppose, why it feels like it's almost the wrong place to concentrate on to try and out-Tolkien in that area of world building, if you like. You know, he's done it already. And then, frankly, a lot of other people have tried to do it since, do something quite similar. And so I think, you know, it's wise to try and focus on other areas and work on those, you know.
But there is a common tie that binds all your books together. They do all take place in the same world. But how important is it for readers to have read the trilogy before they move on to the standalone books?
Well, I tried to make it possible to read the standalones. I mean, I suppose standalone is in a sense a little bit of a lie. Not a total lie, but it's kind of, they're part of the same world and they do share similar characters. I suppose I wanted to try and produce something that new readers could pick up if they wanted to and would hopefully still feel moved to pick up old books, but at the same time give established readers some sense of continuity and seeing some of the characters come in and some of the forward movement of the world itself. But I think, you know, the really big series can sometimes be not that productive both for readers and for the writers sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because although we think of the really big success stories, you know, there are obviously for every huge series, there are those that run out of steam and disappear off the shelves. And if a reader turns up and wants to get into that series, they can't find the first book anymore when the fourth one appears, you know. So there's a downside to doing huge series. And I wanted to give readers the opportunity to jump on. And so the idea is you can certainly start with Best of Coles or with the Heroes. There are some references in there that you might miss the full significance of, but I don't think in a way that would damage your enjoyment of it. I mean, I think people who've read the trilogy very much see them as a continuation and think there are lots of things in here that pick up, but I certainly do talk to a lot of people who've also started with one or the other of the standalones and haven't found it a problem while reading them. But, you know, the ideal place is at the start, probably.
Yeah.
I should say that I read the First Law trilogy and then was about to start reading Heroes, and I had not yet read Best Served Cold, and everyone shouted at me on our forums that I couldn't possibly do that.
You just took the words out of my mouth, because that's exactly the same thing I did. I read the First Law trilogy, and then when the Heroes came out, I started reading it, and I got into the first two or three chapters, and I was like, you know what? They're making references to things I don't know about. I'm going to go back and read Best Served Cold first.
Oddly, that may be actually the exactly what you've described. Reading the trilogy, then missing Best Served Cold might be the most problematic one, because there's quite a lot of stuff in Best Served Cold that sort of lends directly onto what happens in the Heroes. And I was less... You've always got to trade off between the two, between kind of giving people an extension of things that you've already had and then starting something totally new. Mm-hmm. So there's always a compromise to kind of be reached if you're working within the same world. So I've tried to reach it. But my advice is always, you know, just buy all the books. Just buy all the books. Read them at your leisure. Read them in whatever order you like. I'm not too fussy about the reading element, but the buying of them, I
Once you've bought them, they're yours. You can do whatever
you
want.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So we have a very active listenership to our show on our forums, and they really like to dig in and come up with fun stuff to do to discuss the books. One of the things they've been doing is discussing casting choices for Logan and Glotka. And I wondered if we could run some by you. Obviously, this is not binding in any way, but just to get your ideas. What do you think John Malkovich as Glotka?
John Malkovich, yeah. I mean, he's probably a bit old for Glotka now, isn't he?
Right, because I think must be in his 30s, right?
Yeah, so I think sort of mid to late 30s. So he's probably, at that age.
Benicio Del Toro?
Yeah, I could kind of see that. You see, my Paul Bettany was my kind of, was the actor I thought of.
Okay.
I know you've been watching Lost, I saw on your blog. Someone mentioned Michael Emerson from Lost as being a Glotka, and I can kind of see that.
No, I can kind of see that, actually. It's funny, because John Malkovich I actually thought of might make quite a good Baez. But then it's often the case that, you know, if you've got a good actor, then they'll probably do a good job of pretty much any character you give them in the end, won't they?
A beefed up Viggo Mortensen for Logan.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's kind of that's a gimme, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's kind of an obvious one.
Sort of
Viggo Mortensen is the first place you go for anyone in a fantasy. Right. Anyone with a sword.
Yeah. I like Gerard Butler. First. Gerard Butler as an idea. That might be
six pack it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose. You could go there. I forget the name of the actor now. Rome. He plays Titus Pullo in Rome.
Oh, I love... No, that is exactly who I was picturing in my mind. You're right. Now that you said that, he is fantastic.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good choice. He seems to have a bit of a... You know, he's got a sense of humor, while still you can imagine him being dangerous.
Yeah.
Which is key, I think. Sense of humor, though, it's hard to come by, isn't it?
The character is Ray Stevenson.
That's right, yeah.
The actor, Ray Stevenson. Okay. So, sense of humor, then no Russell Crowe.
Maybe I wouldn't care to hold forth on the man's entire personality.
Sure. Dolph Lundgren, maybe.
Dolph Lundgren, yeah. Big fan from back in the day. Yeah.
I'm definitely in the Ray Stevenson camp now, because I'm looking at his picture on Wikipedia. It's so dead on in my mind.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good choice, definitely.
So for the inevitable,
but then you probably end up with you'd probably end up with Dolph Lundgren, as you say.
So what are you working on next? Are you going to continue doing some more books in this world?
Yeah, well, at the moment I'm just involved in the panicking stage of the next book. I find I'm always panicking about one thing or another in the writing process, but I find the start is always the sort of trickiest bit, because that's where you're thinking, you're trying to come up with new characters, you're trying to come up with new ways of writing those characters, and those two obviously are very closely linked, who they are and how you plan to write them. And sometimes you'll put pen to paper and you'll find a character really works quite quickly. And sometimes you'll just have no idea who they are and where you're going with it. And that always takes time to kind of work its way through. And so I'm in that period now. And effectively what I'm trying to do is a Western, really, a fantasy Western. So it's set in the same world, but features some kind of Western notions, and it is a sort of mashing together of various Westerns that I've watched and read over the years. So it's kind of The Searchers meets Outlaw Josie Wales meets Blood Meridian meets Lonesome Dove type of book with swords.
But in the First Law world, yet.
In the First Law world, yeah. So it's kind of... it's not a Western in the sense of setting necessarily of technology, but in the sense of kind of the plots and the types of people, I suppose, and the ongoing sort of feel in the background of it.
Sounds That's a bit the like idea. the general sense of the Dark Tower, which I've just been reading recently, where it's got Western motif, but it's not a Western per se.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm pathetically ill read on King, actually. I mean, it's a set of books that often gets mentioned, but...
I'm only bringing it up because I just started reading it. I was worse than pathetically ill-read on King until, like, December, and I just started tearing through those books.
Right, yeah. Well, they're ones that you can tear through, absolutely.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it's a sort of Western theme, I suppose you might say. The idea with these three, in a way, with Best of Cold Heroes and this new book, was sort of to do standalones that had... a kind of filmic feel and that drew on some filmic inspiration, really. So, you know, Best Served Cold to do a sort of gangster revenge type film in a Machiavellian Renaissance Italy type setting, as you do.
All right.
And then with the heroes to do, you know, a sort of big war film, a big picture war film like Waterloo or Bridge Too Far, those kind of films, and fuse that with a sort of fantasy setting, and then with this one to do a Western. So that's kind of the notion.
Do you draw on your background as a film editor as inspiration for part of that?
I do. I draw on some of the appalling times I had sitting with directors and think I'll never want to do that again. And therefore, the urge then to keep writing is alive and well. No, I do, definitely. I mean, I suppose there's a degree to which everything you do in your life, everything you read, watch, enjoy, everything you experience sort of has a bearing on you, and you'll find coming up at one time or another. And certainly I think the experience of being an editor was pretty important, because there's something about, although obviously film and documentary and music editing, you know, visual editing is very different to writing, the medium is very different, there is something universal in the pacing and the kind of way you go about constructing a scene and the things you the details you'd show, you know, the things you choose to emphasize. I think it was extremely important experience, and also, joking aside, the experience of sitting there with a director and you know, up to a point having to do what you're told. When you work as an editor, you can get a lot of input. It can be very important in the process, but it's still not your baby. At the end of the day, you walk away and someone else, it's their vision. So you have to, when you cut a sequence, maybe you love what you produce, but if the director says, actually, no, I was thinking of something else, you have to take that on and find a way to give them what they want while still maintaining some, you know, element of what you want, finding a good compromise and hopefully finding something that gives you a better result for both of you. And that's very important when working with an editor as a writer, because the last thing you want to do is change your baby often.
Mm-hmm.
But so that experience of having to sit there and say, okay, let's look at this again, let's find a way to make it better, is very useful when an editor comes back with a set of comments and you think, this is nonsense. But then pretty quickly you have to look at it and think, actually, you know what? They've got a point. I can make this better if I do this. Ah, I know. That's much better if I do it this way. So often you don't do exactly what your editor tells you, but it gives you the opportunity to come up with a new way of looking at it, a new idea. And often it can, you know, fall into place a lot nicer that way.
All right, we only got a couple more minutes before we have to wrap up. So we've got five questions from folks on Twitter that I thought we could throw at you sort of rapid fire style.
Do I have to answer in 140 characters?
Yes, exactly. we'll grandfather you an extra few characters if you need them.
Okay.
Jojo Cunningham says, should we be expecting more standalone books, or is he building to a new trilogy, maybe one where that SOB Baez gets his due?
A new trilogy after this next standalone is the current plan. As for people getting their due, well, who knows what their due is? That's the thing, isn't it?
Isn't it?
I wouldn't promise any dues being paid.
Interesting. All right. And then Jay Vreeland says, what do you think of the rise of the Kindle, iPad, Nook type of consumption device? Do you own one or use one currently?
That takes more than 140 characters for sure. Mm. I don't own one or use one at the moment, largely because I don't read that much. How poor does that sound?
It sounds like almost every author we talk to, they're like, yeah, I'm too busy writing. Yeah,
it's terrible. It's obviously very, very interesting, and every author there is has to be extremely interested in how this is developing. At the moment, I think there's still some grace compared to the record industry, because books aren't going to disappear anytime soon, but it's rapidly becoming a very important part of the marketplace, and also because the royalties are potentially a lot better on ebooks in terms of income for authors, it's very important. And my own feeling is really just that we need to produce a slick, effective way of giving people a good product at a price that people agree is reasonable. And then I think if you're doing that, it's not as easy as that. But if you're able to do that, then there's no real challenge. In a way, it's no different to people are minded to be kind of apocalyptic and see the end of the publishing industry in this. And I don't think it is at all. I think it's just a change that has to be adapted to. And there's a lot of difficult red tape and kind of rights issues, because everything is based around the paper kind of model, territories and so on. And a lot of that needs to be sorted out, and I'm sure will do as ebooks become more important and everyone sees it's going to be a big thing for the future, which of course it is.
Chris L. Dickerson asks, how about whether we will see Nine Fingers again? He's such a great character.
Well, in this fantasy western, I mean, my usual approach is to kind of, if I feel I need a certain character in a book and I've got one on the peg, as it were, hanging around from an older book, I try to reuse characters as much as possible. And it may be that I have need for a used up killer desperately trying to escape his past at some point in this new book. I have about 15 characters like that, to be fair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I looked at the next one and it's actually the same question, but phrased differently. VS Robot says, I want the Bloody Nine to come back, but you have to be realistic about these things.
That's it. You have to be realistic. And there is always a risk. People always want more of something, but often that's the time to not give them any more, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to flog that horse until it is past dead. You want to go out on high. And you also, I think, as a writer, need to try new things. You need to try new characters and new sort of modes of storytelling. Or, you know, often you can try things that are very new. Authors will try something spectacularly different and it will be a disaster, and readers will be nonplussed and upset almost. But I think if you just do the same thing over and over, they'll quietly walk away eventually. And so it's the slow death rather than the quick death. And the aim, I think, is probably to find middle ground where you're trying new things, you're trying new characters, new ways of telling the story, so that you're keeping yourself interested and therefore hopefully the readers, because they can tell if you're phoning it in. You know, they can tell if you're bored. You need to keep yourself interested and you need to keep them interested. And I think people will say they want more of the same, but ultimately they want to be moved on as well. So you don't want to bore people.
And to end on a high note, Twitter user Angum says, I like how people piss or need to piss in his books. Ask him about piss.
Well, go ahead. Ask me about piss. That's not a question, is it?
I know it's not actually a question, but, you know, it made me think, the scenes with Dogman, and I don't want to give any spoilers away or anything, but that's one of those personal moments that we kind of look in on in your books.
Yeah.
Well, he's scared. He's scared to go into battle, and that's how he reacts. He always feels like he needs to go. And I thought that was a really great moment.
Yeah, and well, I suppose, you know, fantasy hasn't tended to concentrate heavily on wee and on the toilet. Many people don't want to go there, which is fine. They'll find plenty of other books to read, I'm sure. But to me, you know, that's just a part of life and a part of being human. And people do need to go for a wee. If you were involved in a long and arduous quest, you'd need to wee a lot during that quest. It's the sort of thing that needs to be thought about. And, you know, I obviously, in researching about violence and combat, things of that nature, it did come up that lots of soldiers wee themselves. This is normal thing, pissing yourself in battle. Not really that surprising. And so it felt like that's, you know, was something that should be involved.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. Where can people find your work online?
At www.jarabacrombie.com. You will find all manner of attempts to sell you stuff, as well as me occasionally blogging about negative reviews, computer games, and other nonsense of that kind.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been great to speak to you.
Thank you again to Joe Abercrombie so much for taking the time on his Sunday night to speak with us and tell us about the books. And I think people are going to be really excited about what he has coming up in the future.
What a pleasure to talk to the guy. Obviously has a great sense of humor and really has thought a lot about these kinds of questions. I'm sure he gets asked them a lot, but
should
really
I have
fun
ended
to talk
on the
to.
Piss question? Was that a bad? Was that in bad taste?
No, I don't think okay. He definitely was entertained by it. I'll give you that. Come on.
Well, once again, thank you to our sponsor, Audible. You can get a free audiobook at audiblepodcast.com/sword. And of course, StickerFoo, our partner StickerFoo. You can get you can check out all the stickers over there at stickerfoo.com. Get 10% off the stickers with the code SWORD1. And if you want to send us in an email, you can do so at theswordandlaser@gmail.com. The website, as always, is swordandlaser.com. And follow all the discussions over at Goodreads. You can get there by hitting the discussion tab on the website or by searching for Sword and Laser on Goodreads.com.
We will wrap up Shadow of the Torture by Gene Wolfe next time on Sword and Laser, and then start figuring out what book we're going to kick off with after that.
Absolutely. We'll see you then.
Bye.